So you've decided to give up that old behavior that's been killing you and all you care for and surrender to a power greater than yourself. That's the first step. Surrender is what opens the prison door. Now it's time to walk through that door and into a whole new way of life. Spirituality, self-care, service, social connection, and the simple daily disciplines that pave the way to lasting freedom. This is Positive Sobriety. Welcome to episode 43 of the Positive Sobriety Podcast.
Yeah, we're starting to count them now.
How cool is it, man, that this thing we started a year ago is still rolling and picking up speed?
Well, it is cool, Nate, and I think it's a testimony to our maturing selves that we've stuck with it.
That's bizarre to me, actually. Yeah. And to me, that's a mark of progress in sobriety. I would say that prior to entering recovery, I really was the poster boy for unfulfilled potential, great at starting things, terrible at follow through.
Yeah, I always considered myself an idea person. That's how I always used to, you know, I'm more of an idea person, i.e. you don't actually go, follow up.
Plus, we also have learned how to ask for help. Yeah. So we ask, like, Rex Schnelly.
I was going to say, like, asking Rex. Help!
To do for us what we cannot do for ourselves.
And that is putting it mildly.
Yeah. But, man, what a joy it is. I got to tell you, I know that it's unrealistic for me to aim for, you know, clear serenity and happiness and optimism every moment of every day.
Right.
And I need to know that when the clouds come, these too shall pass, and I don't have to alter people, places, or things, and I don't need to change my feelings. It will. All that to say, it's a bright, sunny, crisp autumn day. I feel fantastic, and I want to stretch this as far as I possibly can.
Yeah, it is. I had an incident. I won't go into all the personal details, but I had an incident recently this last week that it involves some what I would call betrayal of me in a certain way with someone and some people I trusted. And I had a friend of mine go, "Why are you not just raging pissed off?"
Yeah.
And my answer was, well, I'm waiting to get all the facts before I resort to raging pissed offness.
Okay.
Or piss it offness or something.
Yeah.
But secondly, and probably mostly, it isn't about me. It really isn't about me. Mm. I am upset. There are things that are hurtful.
Yeah.
But usually when what sobriety has taught me is that underneath what I would have gone to as my anger is really hurt.
Yeah.
And it's really okay just to go to hurt first.
There you go.
You know, and it's usually easier on other people too, but
sure.
But it is going to hurt first and going, you know, yeah, that, I guess that pisses me off, but I think I'm just really more hurt.
Yeah.
And when I can say that, that's a sobriety, a recovery lesson that I used anger to mask my pain, just like I did a substance.
So
I think that it is a point where we learn the difference.
Yeah, and you don't have to go out now to hurt somebody else.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's get right into the interview. We've got a great guest coming up. Yeah. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment here on the Positive Sobriety Podcast. Welcome back to the Positive Sobriety Podcast, and we have got an excellent guest this week. Hey, Dave, introduce our guest, will you?
Well, yeah, Nate, this is Dave DeRocher, and he is a guy that has had a great recovery story that I heard about and through a friend of mine, and we thought he would make a great guest. He is a former player for the Seattle Seahawks. Some people
that would
know.
Be football.
That would,
that
be,
would
football.
Be professional football.
That would be football.
Yeah. Okay. People who know me know that I had to be coached and told about all that. But I think it's a pretty big deal, apparently, to get to play.
Yeah.
But Dave, welcome. You have a lot more going on for you now today that are some pretty interesting opportunities, and life has taken you in some. Wonderful new directions, but you kind of had, like most of us, the winding road to get there. Tell us a little bit about your background and how you landed where you are today.
Sure. I think windy road is a very nice way of putting it. I don't know if I would describe it as a dirty, dark, ugly road, but I am blessed in a good place and solely because of my sobriety. Mm-hmm. And you did mention, I did play a little bit of professional football and I was very blessed, but my entire life I was blessed. So I don't have, the stories that, that a lot of people have that, get into drugs and alcohol. When you hear the stories, you're going, holy smokes, I get it. I see where you're trying to escape from.
Yeah.
For me, I had two loving parents. I was spoiled, lived in a middle income family, and we traveled and we did everything together. And then I was able to attain a scholarship to play football. I actually played both football and basketball in Division I sports. And that's kind of where the partying started, but there was no rhyme or reason other than that's just what I, kind of started getting into. And the path, and it was just, a typical, I think, collegiate thing. Because the reason I say that is because everyone around me seemed to be doing the same thing.
Yeah.
But I did it more and more often and harder and I think than others did. And I didn't really realize kind of the path I was forging at the time. And it just seemed along the way, every time a great opportunity presented itself, I was able to just destroy it. A quick story, as a matter of fact, when I made the basketball team for San Diego State, there's not many athletes in the country that can letter in two sports in Division I sports.
Sure.
And so we're in Las Vegas, and the first night we lost to Las Vegas, and I had 4 points, 4 fouls in 4 minutes. And I'm a football player. So the next night we beat Florida State, and our head coach said, okay, no curfew. And I know this is a short interview, so I'll keep the story short. I missed the plane the next day. So, everyone else seemed to be able to find their way back to the plane. And that was just, I was out till 6 a.m. I had found some friendly people, and then that's what I, that's how I rolled, I guess. And so it just seemed to be that continued to be the theme. And my partying just kind of seemed to be the more money I had, the more partying I did.
Yeah.
And I became an actor for a little bit. I ran a club called the Roxbury in Hollywood. So a lot of people are familiar with the name Roxbury. And,
yeah, absolutely.
And it was bigger than the movie. It was the who's who of Hollywood every night, Cher, Stallone, Eddie Murphy. And so, as you can imagine, along with that came the party. And the drugs got more illicit and more, and more quantity. Mm-hmm. And so then, and then I started my professional career and became a contractor. And that didn't work out. And I attained my securities licenses. And that's what I did for 20 years. But along the way, I actually became a vice president of a bank, And I was doing so much cocaine and drinking that, you know, I actually even started smoking it. I couldn't breathe.
Wow. So, yeah.
You know, that's not the ideal situation, you know, for a vice president of a bank, but, on the exterior, really, you know, very few people knew what was going on other than I had lost, you know, a fair amount of weight, but, I was always able to maintain for the most part, what I was doing. And I was leading a dual life towards the end where, you know, I would go to my office. I had my own financial planning practice. I would go to my office. I'd get the necessary things done, typically with a little bit of vodka and a little bit of cocaine or whatever, but I'd get some stuff done. And then I'd go hang out with the hoodlums, friends of mine. Well, not friends, acquaintances. That's where I escaped to, and, you know, hit golf balls at the fishermen in the river, and then I'd go back to the office, finish up, then go pick up my family. We'd go to the country club for dinner, and put on that show, and then I'd go back to my office, and that was kind of where things ended. And I think I shared this with you guys before, is that, you know, when I look back, I'm like, you know, why would I do that to myself, and then of course then to my family, because I ended up losing everything back in 2010. You know, I distinctly remember praying every day, please, today I don't want to start drinking, whatever came first was what I had left over from the night before. So whether it was vodka or beer or if it was Coke, that's what started, and then the one begets the other, at least for me.
Yeah.
But it wasn't just that, and it was pills, and it was pretty much whatever was in front of me I would do. But I would pray, okay, today don't start and you'll be all right. Well, you know, it just inevitably it would start. And so, you know, back in 2010 when I lost everything, I think God just finally said, hey, you know, dude, you're not getting it. And so how about trying to do all this with nothing? And he just took everything, because I literally lost, you know, I mean, you know, I'm sure you've had plenty of guests on there that had the five cars and the big house and the motorhome, the, you know, the boat, the this, the that, the, you know, business, $500,000 business, everything went to zero. You know, what was amazing was I was still able to figure out how to party, which was sad.
And,
you know, because now I had a reason.
No, it's priorities.
Well, yeah. And now I had justification, you know.
Yeah.
Right? Look at what she did to me, not what I did to myself. So, you know, it didn't get any better. I moved, you know, out of the area, and I did start over a little bit, but it didn't take me long, and it got worse, and it started getting into meth and pills and opiates and. You know, and that just was all bad. And as I started to build things up, I got into buying and selling antiques, and this, it was just, it got weird. And so finally the gal I was living with just said, you know, man, I can't watch you kill yourself. And so I went from, you know, living with her to, you know, kind of staying on the couch, because I had all this stuff at her house. I mean, just tons of stuff. And then, well, she didn't want me laying on the couch because she wanted to start dating. So I was staying in the garage.
And wow.
So, you know, and God doesn't say, hey, Dave, you know, this isn't working, man. You know, I'm going to figure this out. I can always figure stuff out. Well, then the boyfriend didn't want me staying in the garage. So I started living in the shed. And because you know, and the use just didn't get any better. And at the end, you know, for Pete's sakes, you know, I'm an ex NFL football player, ex millionaire, and I'm chewing fentanyl patches and smoking meth. I mean, so my point to this is that it doesn't matter, man. This stuff can get you, and you don't have to have a horrible life. You can have a blessed life. But you just can't let it in. For those of you that are listening that are just kind of on the tip of this and thinking maybe you've got a problem, if you think it, then you do, and it's not gonna get any better without reaching out and finding any help. Because I went all the way down to a park bench, and I was one night on a park bench, once again prayed, saying, okay, God, maybe I'd not, maybe I don't know what I'm doing. I will do whatever, I will do whatever. And I had been carrying around a phone number with me. My brother, who is a head pastor of a church in Michigan, gave me a number of a friend of ours that we both used to party with in college. And he said, look, this guy has a friend that has a home out in Riverside. So for those of you that aren't familiar with California, I was living in a beautiful area of Southern California. And Riverside is not. And I said, you know what? I have his number and I'm going to call him. And I called him. He said, okay, I'll come get you in the morning. And I'm 6'7", 300 and some odd pounds. I don't fit on park bench as well. So, and this one was at a slight, it was on a slight tilt. So you know, Riverside didn't sound so bad. And he picked me up, and the first place we went was to a soup kitchen for homeless folks. And I'm thinking, okay, dude, this isn't a friend, and this isn't where I'm going to be. But he said, no, we're gonna serve people. You know, I mean, and it was great, you know, and I'm coming off, you know, because I had zero anything left. And so I'm, you know, making, you know, 500 pieces of garlic bread shaken. And we got done with that. He put me in a hotel room. He goes, hey, the next morning, well, he goes, I'll introduce you to my friend. Well, when he picks me up, I go out to a sober living home. Beautiful, you know, a nice home, 13 rooms, because Riverside's got those old colonials. And there's 20-year-olds. They take me to a room. There's two twin beds, and the air conditioning wasn't working. It's 110 degrees. And I looked at that bed and I said, oh, hell no. Yeah. and then I remembered what I prayed. I'm like, dude, where are you going to go?
Yeah.
You know? And so I sat my old fat butt on a twin bed, and I had nothing but a cell phone and a $50 Starbucks card.
Wow.
And that's literally what I had. So the next day we get up, and where are you going to go? There's no air conditioning. I want to go where it's cool. So we're going to a meeting. And so I started going to meetings. And, you know, I'd been arrested twice for possession. I had had the cards. I had been DUI with possession. I didn't finish either one of those. They gave me a Prop 36, which would have erased the charge. Well, I didn't finish either one of those programs. I left Northern California, came to Southern California, went on a Disney cruise of all things to Puerto Vallarta and Cabo. And then when I get back, I'm greeted by Port Authority, U.S. Customs, and LAPD because I've gone out of the country on a warrant.
So nice.
I went on my second vacation to Twin Towers, Orange County, in Northern California, where they OR'd me, you know, and I'm in a shorts and a tank top. Anyways, so the courts weren't going to get me clean and sober. You know, that's my point. The second time was a deferred entry judgment or whatever that was. And I got kicked out of the program three or four times. And the judge finally said, you know, hey, dude, just take the charge, man. You know, it's been 2 years and you can't complete a 3-month program. So for those of you also listening that, you know, you're probably in the same situation, and they can't make you do it. So getting back to Riverside, and I'm going to meetings and I'm looking around, and I'm like, I just kept thinking it was going to be like a churchy, like everybody's goody goody. And I'm not that. What I realized was, no, they're all just messed up like me. And one of my favorite sayings from George Carlin is, hey, just because you get the monkey off your back doesn't mean the circus has left town. Well,
I love it.
That's pretty much true for all of us in where we're coming from. And, you know, and so, I just started going to meetings. But one thing I never got, and I think you guys asked me this before, is that the one thing I had the hardest time with all those things up on the wall. And, you know, it's that, okay, you know, these steps and these suggestions and this, you know, I went to meetings for literally like a year and a half before I even learned the prayer. So
yeah,
I wasn't good. I was going to go, I was going to do this and, you know, but I'm not going to do that stuff because don't you know who I am? You know, I mean, I own businesses. I play professional football. I don't need that help. I just need to stop using drugs and stop drinking. So you know, that was the toughest hurdle. And of course I wasn't going to ask another man for help. I mean, that's just dumb. So, you know, I did have some sobriety, and I'm going to digress just a moment. Just before the park bench, I had about 90 days because my daughter had given birth, had a baby, and was living with my mom. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, I can do this, right? I can do this for my daughter and for my granddaughter. And I stopped everything. And I went up to see her in July of 2014. And I got to see her with her baby. And her baby was about 4 months old, 5 months old. And I was so proud of her. She was only 19. And I just didn't think she'd muster it. But she was doing such an awesome job. And I got home. And 2 weeks later, she called me from the hospital. And I was about to take a 90-day chip. Actually, I think the next day, and she called me from the hospital and told me that the birth father had shaken her baby to death. And so when I finally got up off the ground, and literally, you know, you see, I never believed people really fainted. I didn't faint, but you know, everything left me, and
just collapse.
It was just one of those things. Man, my heart went out to her, and she's, you know, dealing with that, and so that took me all of one day, and that was my worst run. I went right back out because you know, really, as a dad, I'm gonna go find the guy and kill him, you know, all that machismo stuff.
Right.
But you know, but part of the biggest thing was the guilt. I wasn't there to protect her and my granddaughter, you know, from this guy and that kind of thing. So, you know, when you're sitting in the rooms and you're looking at and people are telling you, you know, hey, gee, I'm taking a 30-year chip because I did these things, you know, and you think you're going to do it different. But the one thing that was posed to me, was you can't place your sobriety on something that has a shelf life. And because one guy asked me, goes, you know, so you have a sponsor. I said, no. And I said, you know, I'm doing this for myself. I'm doing this for my daughter. And he looked at me, he goes, what if something happened to your daughter? And I got goosebumps, the chill, because I knew the answer is that, well, shoot, you know, I'd probably go out. And, you know, so anything that has an expiration date to it, or that is going to, you know, not accept it the way you had envisioned it and disappoint you. And then you're like, well, what am I doing this for? That person doesn't even understand what I'm doing it, you know? And most of us aren't going to get that. Most of us aren't going to get the positive feedback. We have to earn that. And we just think, as we're sober, that everyone's going to love us again. Well, if you're like me, you did a lot of things that you have to overcome, you know, when you're talking 50 years of doing this. So, you know, I got a sponsor, and started working on the steps, because no matter what happens in your life, those never go away, and they're always constant, and they're always just what they are. And it gives you something that you can use and rely on. And then also just the whole process of the cleansing and coping with things. You know, that's like the biggest thing. It was the hardest thing for me to do in this whole thing, this whole process.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's kind of my story. But now, you know, it's amazing. It's only been 4 years, October 27th, 2014. And that's not the actual date. Cause frankly, I don't know what it was. Cause honestly, I didn't think I was going to do it. Mm-hmm. And so I, you know, whatever day it was, I ended up on Riverside. And I was hanging on for a few months, but I picked that date because it is my daughter's birthday. I knew I'd never forget it. And so once again, so she can't keep me sober, but she got me sober. Mm. And there's a difference.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people say I'm doing this for, or I'm doing this because, well, okay, that's the reason. But if you rely on that solely to keep you sober, something's going to happen at some point. They're going to fail you. That's going to fail you. And you're not going to have anything to fall back on.
Yeah.
So, but since that time, you're right. It's been a path. It's been, you know, and it wasn't just automatically, oh, hey, I'm sober. Look at, hey, I got a brand new car today. I walked.
Yeah.
And I took a bus and, but I got a job, and then that job begot another one. And, you know, and I had a lot of success professionally, and I do have some wherewithal when I'm lucid. And so when things, when things started presenting themselves, I was able to take advantage of them. And today I'm a vice president and partner of a company that helps kids. We have two online programs. One is for students. They're trying to determine their major. So we help them figure out, okay, what are you going to be happy and successful doing the rest of your life? Mm-hmm. That's going to predicate what you should major in. And then we have another program that helps veterans, that helps people in transition or people wanting to transition, which is about 70 million Americans currently. Mm-hmm. And we help them figure out, all right, so you're in this job now. You've already made that mistake. What should you be doing? And right. And empower them to make those steps. So that's a pretty neat thing. I'm also the vice president of the Players Association. I own a online distribution company, and I'm writing a book. And then I do a lot of things like this, because what I determined when I look back is that big question of why. Why did I go into a K-hole? Why did the guys that were helping me move my stuff out of my office say, hey, have you tried this dust off? And I said, no, I got three cans. Why, what do you do with it? And they showed me, and then I had no cans. It doesn't matter what it was, is if it got me out of me, I did it, and I did a lot of it. So why was that? Why did I make those choices? And I believe it's so that today, I don't care what you're doing. I never put a needle in my arm, but I did enough oxys and Norcos in a day to, I can assure you, equate the same issue. And is that I know why.
Yeah.
And I can help. And I can look at somebody and they're like, oh, I heard about that, or I read about that. No, I did that. I get it. And let me tell you where that's going to take you, because that's where it took me. And it's real life stuff, and I can empathize and know why they're making the bad choices, why they're having a hard time saying goodbye to it, or why they go back to it, and be a catalyst to help them not do that, to not make that choice, to talk them through, okay, where are you going to go with this?
Yeah. Dave, when did you know that you were going to have to not just focus on the behavior of your addiction, but actually, like you mentioned earlier, the why of why you were doing it? Was there a particular time when you began to realize that if I only focus on using or not using, I'm going to just be on the white knuckle, you know, method to sobriety? When did you know you were going to have to look at causality?
Well, it was a few years in. I have no shortage of confidence in that. You know, I can do anything I can set myself out to do, because I've done that,
right,
across all fronts, business, personal. You know, if you've seen the gals I've dated, I've overachieved there. I overachieve everywhere. So, but you know, I can do sobriety better than anybody else without having to do the stuff you guys did. And it was that, I tell you, that one question posed to me in that one coffee meeting about placing my sobriety on something with a shelf life, really was a big deal. But always in the back of my head, I always wondered, why was I always messing up everything? Mm-hmm. You know, why was I doing this? And to be honest, nothing really emerged. I mean, like I said, I have no trauma, no childhood trauma. Parents mm-hmm. were, you know, married until my dad passed away. Loving, giving, caring, supportive.
Right.
And so there wasn't any of those causalities. It was just a personal preference, and then the disease of addiction. And it was something, you know, when, you know, some of these guys walk into these meetings, you see them, you know, and they're new, and they, you know, they're, you know, you could tell they were a badass at one point, or still think they are. And you look at them, you go, you guys don't even realize you're getting your butts kicked every single day. You know, don't walk in here all hard. because you know, and I'm 6'7", 310 pounds. I was getting my butt kicked every day.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's really the only fight I've ever lost, and I was losing it every day. And so, you know, I had to find a strength from somewhere. And you know, I love doing things like this. I love going and talking. I love being, believe me, this isn't the story that I thought I'd be telling people. You know, I thought I'd be telling them I was, you know, about to go into the Hall of Fame and I was a great football player. Or, you know, I'm about to sell my business for $5 million. And none of that came to fruition. I'm telling a story and humbling myself so that way it can maybe help somebody. Yeah, man, if you just think that this is something you're having a hard time with, reach out and find some help from somebody and talk to somebody about it, because it probably is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Dave, it sounds like this dedication to serving others has become part of your new way of life. We know that in recovery, we find a new way of life, that it's not about what we're not doing. It's not negative sobriety. It's positive sobriety. It's what we're doing instead. What would you say are other ways in which you live your daily life differently today? How have your priorities shifted, and how have your practices changed, your daily practices? What does positive sobriety look like to you?
Well, I will tell you. So I'm also working on a faith-based camp with some local people here to bring like a missionary message to kids through sport. Is that I live my life with purpose instead of an agenda.
That's great. I love that line. Instead of an agenda.
Yeah, you know, with purpose, you're living outside of yourself. You're forging relationships. You're doing things for others, and you're building something. When you have an agenda, it's about self, you know. And you're what is in this like your and I discussion right now, you know. If it was an agenda, I'd be thinking, okay, how can you know what can I leverage these guys for that's going to benefit me? I think you can tell by my stories that this isn't about me. Because, you know, if it was about me, I'd be painting a pretty big, I would give you my LinkedIn bio.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
That looks really good.
Yeah.
So it's about being of service to others. And, you know, I tell people, you know, in sales and living and doing, using that same scenario in sales, is that, you know, if you forge relationships, that it will pay off, maybe not necessarily with that person, but with other people.
Yeah.
But if you sit across from somebody and all you see is a dollar sign over their head, you've already lost. Because, you know, if you're a good salesperson, you'll probably get that dollar, but they'll realize it and they'll never do business with you again, nor will their families, you know. Yeah. So those kind of scenarios. But just in the broader scope of things, I just kind of keep that. I try and keep that in mind in everything I do. If somebody asks me to do something, the first answer is yes. And then I say, oh, let me check my calendar. So.
Yeah. I'm wondering, I'm intrigued by the path to happy success, this company that you're working with that helps people, young people choose a major and other folks in transition make a better choice as to where they should go. I'm wondering, it seems to me now as though, I know that, Dave, I know that if I'm speaking personally, it's much easier for me to resist temptation and to make intelligent, wise choices when I'm doing something that I love and that I know I was built to do, and I'm really operating within a God-given purpose. It's tougher for me when I feel like I'm upstream, I'm a fish out of water, I'm doing something I'm unsuited for. Do you see a link between sobriety and vocation?
Absolutely. So two things came to mind while you were saying that. One thing is that happiness always breeds some form of success. Success doesn't always necessarily breed happiness.
And
so when you're happy doing, you are going to either monetarily be more successful or emotionally and personally more successful at home and with your family life and just in your overall well-being. So yes, I agree with that. The other thing that I want to share is that for 2 years, I owned a sober living home. And, you know, with a whole 1 year of sobriety, I was going to fix the world. But I felt that, hey, look, I've got the wherewithal. I know people that will buy me a $1 million home here in Orange County, and they did. And I told them what the idea was. And the problem with recovery in Southern California, especially South Orange County, is that there's so much money in it that it's about the money, and it's no longer about sobriety. And these kids get shuttled off. I had one kid get a phone call from their treatment center offering them $1,500 to relapse so they could get their $8,000 a week again.
What?
And so going back to watching these young people, and I had like 9 people in a house, and it was a really nice house. And I didn't have twin beds because I hated my twin bed. I had full beds. And so, because I remember my experience, I wanted it to be everything that wasn't.
Yeah.
But here's the problem. Here's the problem is that these people then would get their get well jobs, right, as they're told to do. And an average bed in a nice home in South Orange County is $1,500 a month. I was only charging $1,000. Keep in mind, these are $1 million homes, and we can only fit so many people in. And so when that was all said and done and they got their paychecks, they had maybe $200 or $300 left over.
Yeah.
And it did not take long for the discouragement and the, what am I doing? And this sucks. And this is, I'll never get anywhere doing this. And then where do you go? You go back to what you thought made you happy. You go back to what was working or what you thought was working because right. You tried it and I'm never going to make it doing this. And I closed it because I decided that there's no way I am going to make money on somebody else's sobriety. That first, so purpose versus agenda, right? I thought, well, I'm going to have 5 of these houses. I'm going to be making a ton of money. I'm going to help people because it's a nice house. I wasn't helping anybody. And these guys, you know, well, there were some that, you know, did quite well. But I just saw that there being a disconnect in that if you aren't doing this solely to help somebody, then you're not doing it for the right reason and it's not going to work. And that's why it's not working down here. Yeah. But, you know, so yeah, so getting back to, you know, finding out what you love doing, these kids didn't love flipping burgers at Five Guys, you know.
Right.
You know, so if in treatment, if we can help folks, you know, get away from what they were doing and point them in a new direction and not only inspire them, but empower them. And right. Because a lot of people just have self-doubt and they go, I can't do that. I can't be an engineer. Well, you know what? Everything within your aptitude, personality, interests, preferences, and traits say that you can. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so go do it. And that's what our program does. I know that we spoke before, just so everybody knows. And here's the cool thing about being an ex-football player. I get to blame concussions and now age as to why I forget stuff. But I have discount codes for you, and I don't have them off the top of my head, but maybe you guys can post them on your website.
We absolutely
to allow your listeners to get a discount off of our programs, both our student and our career transition program. We'll take $100 off. The website is www.path2happysuccess.com. So path2happysuccess.com, and enter the discount codes that the guys will post up there for you, and we'll give you a discount off of our program.
Dave, that is so generous. We so appreciate it, and our listeners will, and I hope they will all take advantage of that, those who are considering transitions in their careers and in life and just assessment. And do you find that as people are getting into their sober season of life that many people feel the need to make a career path change to find purpose and maybe find what their real aptitude and gift mix is? Are you finding a lot of people coming in from the recovery circles?
We are starting to, and only because it just is, it's a perfect fit, right? So right. How many times do we hear, you only have to change one thing and that's everything. There's so many reasons, you know, why, you know, I remember sharing this one story with a buddy of mine that You know, so I was, as I mentioned, I was a vice president of a bank for a short period. So banking was maybe about 5 years out of my 20-year career. The majority of it was spent doing financial planning and investment management, which I really loved. Mm-hmm. Well, so I was partying with a friend of mine who had asked me to get him some cocaine. And as I mentioned, I was to the point where I couldn't ingest it through my nose anymore. So I'm smoking it and we're drinking. And he looks at me and goes, "Why did you start doing this?" You know, and I go, "You know, I'm unhappy in my marriage. I'm unhappy with my job." And he goes, "Well, Dave, I know a lot of people that aren't happy in their marriage and don't like their job, but, you know, they're not smoking crack." So, but on the other hand, you know, yes, you know, we're dissatisfied with a lot of things. And it's so cool to see somebody light up and just take a whole new path and to embark on something that's fresh. And that they're going to be happy and enjoy doing. And a lot of times it's a 180 degree. And sometimes it's just a variation of what they were doing before.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Well, Dave, thank you so very much for joining us again. I apologize again for I'm the guy who screwed up technically.
Well, our listeners don't exactly know what happened yet, Nate.
Yeah. We'll fill them in when this is over. Okay. I'll tell you, this is proof that this guy is doing this for others, is that he actually sat through this interview twice within the space of a month.
That's a testimony to his sincerity.
Yeah.
And, Dave, and
thank
guys,
you so much.
And guys,
running. Yeah.
Guys, I'll do it again. I'll do it again if you
All right, don't jinx it, man. Don't jinx it.
Well, we will have you on again, Dave, but it'll be because we want to hear more and people will have heard the first time. So.
Okay. I'll do that too. You bet.
All right.
Thank you for your generosity again and giving our listeners an opportunity to take advantage of what you all do. I know that's a great offering and we will look forward to being able to post that information when we post this podcast.
Very good.
Okay. Take care, man.
All right. Have a blessed day, guys.
You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And welcome back to the Positive Sobriety Podcast. And Nate, that conversation was so great, but I'm having a sense of deja vu. Can you tell me why I feel like I've done this before?
Yeah. Our listeners may have picked up at the end of the interview on the fact that that's not the first time we talked to Dave DeRocher.
Correct.
So if there was a week, maybe a month ago, where you expected to see a fresh episode of the Positive Sobriety Podcast on your player, and it wasn't there. The reason is that I was sort of doing Rex's job that day.
Speaking of being grateful for Rex.
And I was responsible for recording the conversation and saving the file and passing it on to Rex so that he could turn it into a finished show. And somewhere along the line, my massive, highly refined technical skills failed. And that first conversation was lost in cyberspace somewhere.
Yeah. I just remember getting the I could tell this. I just remember getting the email that said, "Well, shit." And I'm like, "Oh no." Do you think he'll talk to us again?
So Dave DeRocher's a good man.
He is a great man.
He came right on.
Absolutely a testimony to his willingness to put his message out there.
Yeah,
it's a testimony to his commitment.
Yeah. Well, and you have been busy. I really appreciate, David, that you have taken really the initiative to fill up the calendar with great guests.
Oh man,
we've got some good shows on the horizon.
We do, and I thank you for that. I appreciate getting to do it. And what's really, like I said before, what's interesting is we're starting to hear people coming to us mm-hmm. and asking if we might consider them or someone they know to be on the show, which mm-hmm. is great because that means people are listening and identifying, and
yeah.
it makes my job easier to find a guest. So we're looking like we're booked through the end of the year, just about.
Oh, fantastic. So fantastic.
It's fun.
All right. And we do love to hear from you, listeners. Our email address, quite simply, is positivesobrietypodcast@gmail.com. Well, until next week, then, I'm Nate.
I'm David.
And we are your pals on the Positive Sobriety Podcast. The Positive Sobriety Podcast is recorded at Crossroads for the Nations in Brentwood, Tennessee. Live producer Rex Schnelly. Music by Rex Schnelly. Theme music by Matt Ulrich. Hair and makeup by Lyle Lovett. Wardrobe by Kathy Gifford.